thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
There we go.
Here's John Williams.
Got one right now. Watch this. All by myself. It's 108 on WGN. Hi, it's John. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan. That'd be Michigan Avenue to you, and we sure appreciate you tuning in. Along the way, you want to join us? Send in a text, 312-981-7200, or call that very same number. So Schwarber is going to bat fifth for the Cubs in his return. Well, that's good to hear, Ryan. Fifth, is that what I heard you say? Batting fifth, Schwarber back?
I'm sorry, yeah. Yeah, he's batting fifth playing left field.
All right. This is the sort of game where he doesn't need to go 3 for 4. He doesn't need to hit a home run.
Well, we'll see how the game plays out. We may need that.
I know. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, no kidding. But to me, Project Schwarber, they don't want to send him back twice. You send him back. He got to swing back to evidently enough form that they feel comfortable. And mentally, he got enough quality of bats. Hit about 4 home runs down there in Iowa that he feels like he can do it again. Okay, got that fixed. You know, if you send it back twice in the same season, then it's something different. So he's back, and this is what we're going to get.
The question is, was he there to get better at something that he wasn't doing well at, or was he down in Iowa just to clear his head?
Yeah, I think it's more the latter. And that's why I say, to me, it's not about him hitting a home run and winning the game, doing something mythic. He doesn't need to be 3 for 4. I would be happy with this, 1 for 4 with a single and 1 strikeout. What I don't want to see today is 3 strikeouts and a ground out to the right side.
Agreed.
That's the Schwarber that we sent to Iowa.
How about this? 3 strikeouts and a home run. A solo home run, but 3 strikeouts. Because we've seen that a couple times too, haven't we?
That one I'll take.
All or nothing, it seems like, sometimes.
You know, and that's how the game is played anymore. It's not a small ball game. They don't even like stealing bases anymore. It's hit home runs and get walks. It's billy ball. So to me, if he got a home run, that would be fine. I mean, really, that's kind of the Schwarber we had last year. Although, actually, he maybe even gave you more hope than 3 strikeouts and a home run. But I think I would take that. But what I don't want to see is 3 strikeouts and a ground ball to the right side, or 3 strikeouts generally. And I know it's not fair to judge anybody by the first game back, for goodness sakes. But if you were going to judge his return by just 1 appearance starting today, that's what I'm hoping for. Just be average, just be good enough, and then you'll get your major league swing back.
Kind of a big game against the Brewers, too.
Yeah, I know. All of a sudden, Milwaukee looms large for us.
You don't want to slide too far back in the standings. If you can pick one away here and get yourself on a nice little roll going into the All-Star break, you're in pretty good shape. But a loss, that could be kind of tough.
Speaking of sports, Senator Dick Durbin joins us now to comment on Schwarber's return to the lineup. Senator, your thoughts?
I think he's ready. I think, 11 games down in the Iowa team. Sounds like he's hitting the ball again. But, you know, this is so much, what do they say, 95% of this is mental, or how did Yogi say it?
Yeah.
But whatever. I hope his attitude is right.
Yeah, it was like 95% is mental and the other half is physical, or something like that. I don't know. Aleph, you need to give me that. Yogi Berra, 95%, the mental part of the game of baseball. I don't know, something like that. Now you got me scratching my head about the quote. Senator, welcome back to the show. We appreciate you joining us. A couple of questions for you today. I wanted to ask a little bit, since you have issued a press release and people are talking nationally about the President's Advisory Commission on Voter Integrity. In the Sun-Times today, they're quoting the Cook County Clerk David Orr as saying, "I strongly encourage the Illinois Board of Elections, as well as my fellow elections administrators, to be cautious of the motives of the Integrity Commission and to not comply with this dangerous request." The Chicago Tribune reports that it was late in getting to Illinois, the official letter from the Federal Commission, because they sent it to the wrong address. What's your overarching view about this? What's so dangerous about this?
Well, I'm very skeptical. First, it's an advisory commission to the president. It was not created by statute. It has no subpoena power. They're asking for voluntary disclosure of records. It is officially chaired by the vice president, Mike Pence, but the vice chair is the person that gives me pause, a fellow named Chris Kobach. I know him. I've sworn him in before my subcommittee. He's testified. He's well-known on Capitol Hill. He has these conspiracy theories about immigrants who are undermining our election process, and virtually no evidence to back it up. The only serious analysis of voter fraud in America since 2010 finds 31 cases of voter fraud out of 1 billion ballots cast. Nevertheless, Kobach continues to make the case that immigrants stole the election. Of course, this commission was created by the president, who believes he actually won the popular vote. You may remember he cited as his expert on this Gerhard Langer, the former golfer who supposedly was standing in line to vote and saw foreigners voting in front of him. Then they went to Langer, and he said, "I never said anything like that." So this is another one of those mysterious tweets that's turned into a commission.
Justin Levitt is the person who authored that report that you were talking about that said it's virtually non-existent where you have voter impersonation. There are other ways to fraudulently affect an election. And so while maybe there's not much incidence of that, maybe there are other things they could discover. I mean, if there's...
There are possibilities out there, but keep in mind we are dealing with thousands of elected and appointed election officials of both political parties. And to say that Mr. Kobach and his commission has spotted things which all of these people have somehow missed is a little hard to handle. And look at the responses that are coming back from states, including the state of Indiana, the vice president's home state, and other states, Kansas, saying we're not going to comply with your, quote, voluntary request to turn over information about driver's license numbers and the last four digits in your Social Security number and what your military status is. I understand it. I really think we need to be careful when it comes to this sensitive voter information. If this were a real statutory commission with real subpoena powers and balanced, a bipartisan balance, then I'd have a lot more faith in what they're trying to do.
It's interesting to me how few states seem to be relishing the opportunity to participate in this all-important commission. I have them listed in front of me alphabetically. The first three are red states. Alaska said public information does not include the last four numbers of the Social Security number, the date of birth, the residence of address. That will not be released. Arizona is not fully cooperating. Arkansas is not fully cooperating, etc. And a lot of them say they're just hamstrung by law. And yet the vice president and the commission says what we're asking for is public information. This is not asking for something that anybody couldn't find out. I'm confused about that, Senator.
Each state is different. We allow states to establish standards for registration and the information that they will gather and disseminate. And so that's why you have such different responses. But I think the premise is the important part. There are seven members of this commission, two Democrats out of the seven. It is a commission without subpoena powers. It is only advisory to the president. And the premise of this commission was, you know, the president really won the popular vote. He could prove it with this commission's finding. What a waste of time. You know, there are important things for us to consider, not the least of which is whether a foreign nation, namely Russia, tried to invade our electoral process. Our intelligence agencies believe that they did. So do I.
Yeah, this does seem to be a commission that is trying to fix a problem that doesn't exist, but we'll see how that goes. Let me ask you about North Korea. What should the United States' response be? How do we play this ICBM story?
Well, I was there about 3 weeks ago. It was a few days after the new President Moon took office, and I met with him and spent about 36 hours. It was a whirlwind visit to Seoul, South Korea. It is a horrible situation. Kim Jong-un, the leader in North Korea, is irrational and irresponsible, and he has his hand on nuclear weapons. We're worried about his delivery capacity. The most recent missile launch suggests that he has a larger range to fire in than we ever believed. But we know he is moving toward the day when he can deliver a missile in the United States. So what do we do in the meantime? What this president's doing is what others have done before him. I understand the pressure points, China. 90% of North Korea's exports go to China. If China had said, we're going to start putting the squeeze on North Korea, they'd sit up and take notice. But China's unwilling to do that for a number of reasons. They don't want to lose the entire Korean peninsula to the United States. We currently have a strong position in South Korea. They don't want to see us take over the whole peninsula. So they're worried about that aspect of it. And secondly, though, they don't want a nuclear war. They have really been reticent and reluctant to help us in putting pressure on North Korea. The alternative, incidentally, let's nuke them. By the time we delivered whatever weapon working to deliver in North Korea, they would have devastated hundreds of thousands of innocent people in South Korea, including a lot of Americans.
Really, the only way to deal with North Korea is to deal with China, huh?
It looks like the only avenue at this point, the only thing they're paying attention to. You know, we could ignore it, which is unacceptable when they're threatening the United States. We could accept it for what it is, and as I said, that is not a viable option. We could talk about a confrontation. We have 28,500 American troops in South Korea. They are literally have the artillery trained on Seoul, South Korea, and our base is there. Or we can try to negotiate with a man who is irrational and half crazy. Those are all terrible options. Using China seems to be the only way that we can push it in the right direction.
Senator Durbin, the president has focused on Chicago many times for its crime problem. He's actually forwarded funds to help fund a few dozen more agents here. One of our texters writes, ask Senator Durbin what he thinks about the amount of shooting in Chicago over the weekend. 86 people shot, 14 others killed. The five-day weekend total comes to 100. What about that, Senator?
It's horrible. It is disgusting. You know, the combination of hot weather, drugs, booze, guns all over the place, and people who, frankly, have no sense of responsibility toward innocent people leads to this wholesale killing taking place. There are ways to approach it. None of them are overnight cures, not one. Bringing in more resources to the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms is going to help us trace the guns used in these crimes. But this is all a long process. We need, as the president said, for the feds to send in resources. The 20 and ATF are a step in the right direction.
Steve Bertrand's in the WGN Radio newsroom.
Senator, seeing, I think New York Times might have reported it first, that Walter Schaub, the director of the U.S. Office of Government Ethics, announced his resignation today, appointed by President Obama. His term was to go into, I think, next year. He's going to join a private group, but he said there isn't much more I could accomplish at the Office of Government Ethics given the current situation. And I just wondered what your comment was on that news.
This is the only president in modern times to refuse to disclose his income tax returns. We have seen in the nominee set before us to fill his cabinet a litany of questions, if not concerns, about their own conflicts of interest. When Penny Pritzker was chosen to be the Secretary of Commerce by President Obama, she went through literally a six-month process of disclosing everything, changing all of her legal arrangements to make sure that there was no hint of impropriety. This administration doesn't view it the same way. They believe that if the president named a person, we ought to approve him without asking the ethical questions. I can understand why the man in charge of that office decided to seek another job.
I have one last question, Senator, about dealing with North Korea and the concern, of course, that South Korea has and how it relates to us. And I read in passing somewhere in the last couple of days that one thing the president could do that would help would be to appoint an ambassador to South Korea. I didn't realize that post was vacant. And could you comment just on how well we've staffed our diplomatic corps?
It's horrible. What's happened is this president has said about one-fourth of the normal number of nominees for positions of these ambassadors for the post. They just don't have their act in terms of setting his names. Now, he may blame us for obstruction. I might add it's a Republican-controlled United States Senate. But the fact is, we're moving these names through. Some of the people don't send the ethics forms that require the financial disclosure. That slows things down a little bit. And what adds insult to injury, and you have to understand the history a little bit, is that we did fill the post of ambassador to Japan, but not to South Korea, and they noticed that right away. There is this age-old enmity between Japan and Korea, and the fact that we filled that spot first did not escape their attention.
Senator, nice to visit with you. We'll visit again, hopefully when you're in studio or closer in range, but I appreciate you joining us today.
I'll get that Yogi quote. Before I come back to see you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to. Thank you, Senator.
All right.
McDurbin is evidently mobile and heading away from the cell that we started with. But I think you got the gist of that last answer, too. Yeah, we were. I don't know, Steve. I don't want to start on a tangent again today. We spent a lot of time on one yesterday. But what's the Yogi Berra quote? Baseball's 95% mental, and so, you know, he had a quote about how baseball is mental versus
right.
Elif said that she'll be able to fill us in on this baseball tidbit.
95% of baseball is 50% mental.
Something like
no,
that.
It's baseball is 90% mental and the other half is physical.
Ding,
yes,
ding, ding.
Yes, that's exactly what he just said.
So do it again, Elif.
Okay, baseball is 90% mental and the other half is physical.
There you are.
Hey, Elif.
Yeah.
Who was Yogi Berra?
A baseball player?
Hello, Steve. Do we have to go
have
slow
been?
For you?
She doesn't have a second sentence.
The reason we even bring it up is because we're just hoping. Do you agree with me, Steve? Schwarber comes back.
Yeah.
What I want from him tonight is not 3 for 4. He doesn't have to hit a homer and a double. What I more want for Schwarber tonight.
Today, actually, they're playing.
Right, is what I did. Actually, any moment now, don't listen to them. They're not on the radio.
He's 4 for 3.
Imagine that. What I want for him is more what I don't want to see from him. I don't want to see him strike out 3 times. I don't want to see him have some feeble at-bats where he starts to get in his head again.
Mm.
You know, I want him to just go 1 for 4.
A nice line drive
to right. Yeah, right. Maybe a hard grounder to short. He could even strike out for all I care, but I don't want to see 3 Ks, something like that.
Maybe hit by a pitch once just to build up the
get your OBP
the aggressiveness
up
and yeah.
I've just been handed a list of Yogi Berra's greatest sayings. Oh, this will be fun. And also, what happened over the 4th of July weekend? Somebody asked the senator about that. He said nothing new. I don't know what you're supposed to say. The Mincing Rascals, our weekly podcast that will go up later today on WGNradio.com, discussed it, and we didn't come up with any solutions either. You can just shake your head and be angry. I mean, you got to start there. And then if you're Mayor Rahm Emanuel, you got to come up with something more concrete. Take a relaxing journey back in time to an historic village once called the Wonder of the West, Cruising, Indiana. That's tonight on WGN TV News at 9. You know, anybody looking to buy a home today knows that inventory is tight and you could be competing against other offers. Don't you hate it when that happens? So how do you get the seller to pick you above the others, especially if you're putting less than 20% down? What if the lender offered a $1,000 guarantee to both you and the seller to back up the pre-approval letter? The worst thing that could happen then is that you get $1,000 and the other guy does too. That might just get your offer accepted. That's exactly what Brian Wickard and his team at AccuNet Mortgage will do for you with their one-of-a-kind, rock-solid, guaranteed pre-approval. Unlike the vast majority of banks who just check your credit, AccuNet also verifies your down payment, income, and anything else needed to guarantee to you and the seller in writing that you'll make good on that offer. So don't settle for some flimsy bank pre-approval. Get started with your rock-solid guaranteed pre-approval today. Click on the blue button at AccuNet.com, A-C-C-U-N-E-T.com. AccuNet Mortgage is an equal housing lender and an Illinois residential mortgage. Licensee NMLS ID number. Hey, John, what's that number? I'm writing this down. 255-368. There are 13,000 West Silver Spring Drive, Butler, Wisconsin, 53007. By law, we have to say that. When I become king, we won't. Back into the newsroom. Hey, Steve. Oh, straight into news, you said in my ears, don't break for news. Keep doing this. Fair enough. So here are some of those Yogi Berra sayings.
I just aged about 3 years. Just
Steve
so you know.
Just went, holy cow. The news is supposed to start in 3 minutes. That means I've got 6. When you come here, Steve, I'll do the first half. You do the second half.
Okay.
Yogi Berra, when you come to a fork in the road.
Take it.
You can observe a lot by.
Listening.
Just watching.
Just watching.
He's a radio guy. And over.
Till it's over.
It's like deja vu.
All over again.
No one goes there nowadays.
It's too busy.
Too crowded.
Too crowded.
Baseball's 90% mental and the other.
Half is physical.
A nickel ain't worth.
A dime these days.
And you are good. Even if you don't know, you kind of get the rhythm.
Right, exactly.
You know. We made too many wrong
mistakes. Okay.
Always go to other people's funerals. Otherwise,
they won't come to yours.
Ding, ding, ding. I'll give you one more.
Okay.
Congratulations. I knew the record would stand until it was broken.
Mm.
That's not as famous a one. Everybody pair up in threes.
There was a story told about streakers in the 70s at spring training.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is true, but he said, yeah, one person jumps over the fence, runs all the way across and over the dugout and leaves. And then as soon as they were done, the other one came over. They had bags over their heads. You couldn't see their face, and they ran, and then they escaped. Yogi, was it a man or a woman? How do I know? I said they had bags over their heads.
By the way, Steve, 134 WGN Radio. This is John Williams. We were just going over some Yogi Berra comments. Has to do with Kyle Schwarber trying to get his head right, which led us to that baseball is 90% mental and the other half physical line. So then you go down that road and you can't stop. These are like snacks. You just keep throwing them in. Well, I'll give you a couple more.
Okay.
The one I was looking for was the one he said about restaurants. You know, it's too crowded. Nobody goes there anymore.
Right.
Or something like that.
Nobody goes there anymore. It's too crowded.
The future ain't
ahead.
The future ain't what it used to be.
If
the people don't want to come out to the ballpark, nobody's going to stop them. He said this. He hits from both sides of the plate. He's
not going to go. I don't know.
Yeah, that one's not in true Yogi Berra fashion. This one is more like something, I don't know.
He's ambitious.
He's amphibious.
Amphibious.
He hits from both sides of the plate. He's amphibious. It's 1:35 now. We asked Senator Durbin about the violence in Chicago over the holiday weekend. I don't know that there's any point in counting a five-day weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. The fourth is on Tuesday, so you throw in Monday. I know that's sort of how we all did the 4th of July, but then you really have a five-day span, and I don't know, as Steve said earlier, that that's really any valuable comparison, but that way you get to 100. You know what I mean? The toll of the holiday weekend, therefore, says the headline, reaches 100 shot and 14 killed in Chicago. 14 people, I'm reading from the Sun Crimes now, and 86 others were wounded in shootings across Chicago in a bloody, extended 4th of July weekend from Friday afternoon through early Wednesday morning. Last year's Independence Day, which was one day shorter, ended with 66 people shot, 4 fatally. Don't know what to do about that. But as I go through the papers, some of the stories about what's happened the last several days are just kind of trickling in. A Southside man was charged with aggravated drunk driving after his Mini Cooper collided with a Chicago police squad car. The squad car was parked on Lakeshore Drive on the 4th of July. You do not want to run into a squad car. You don't want to run into anything. But boy, if you've ever done that, tap the bumper of or worse of a squad car, you think, oh, this is not going to go well for me. And if you're drunk, it's really going to go bad. Daniel Soto, age 29, behind the wheel of a Mini Cooper near the Oak Street curve on Lakeshore Drive at 3:30 in the morning. Boy, nothing good's going to happen there. He got all banged up. The judge has set his bail at $500,000, aggravated DUI, multiple traffic counts. A weirder one is Kaylee Richardson, this also from the Sun Crimes. A Chicago police commander was shoved in the face by a Logan Square woman. She shoved First District Commander Robert Klitsch in the face, according to police reports. According to the police report, the 5'4" Richardson struck Klitsch with an open hand palm. How drunk or dumb do you have to be to slap a cop in the face? That's never going to end well. People who don't deserve to get whacked, get whacked. You whack a cop, it's not going to go well for you. Klitsch arrived at the Belmont Harbor, and here's what got her set off. The cop arrives at Belmont Harbor, with other officers in response to a call that Kaylee Richardson had been loudly complaining to Chicago firefighters. The firefighters were there because a friend of hers had been rescued from the water after falling off a personal watercraft. So there they are on the 4th of July weekend, zipping around on a skidoo. Somebody falls off. They call the firefighters. They dive in, save the person. And then she's standing there giving a hard time to the firefighters. The police come to say, "What's your problem, lady?" And she slaps them in the face. Richardson had been driving the watercraft and was berating the crew of an ambulance that had arrived to tend to her friend. Richardson first told the officers that she had been drinking, quote, earlier in the day. and was sorry she muffed the officer. I don't believe officers write down "got muffed" on their police report. Later, Richardson denied that she hit the officer and said she simply pulled his microphone cord. $100,000 bail for her. Which leads me to this story here. How about the story of the FBI agent who left his car running? It's 3 o'clock in the morning. 32-year-old FBI agent goes inside a gas station, and he leaves his Equinox, his Chevy Equinox, quote-unquote, momentarily unattended with the engine running. It's 12:10 in the morning, in this case, Monday, in the 300 block of South Morgan. And that's when a teenager jumps in, and he's about to take off. The cop leans in, the FBI agent, and says, "I'm the police, I'm the police. You don't want to do this." And the kid hits the gas, drags the guy. The officer gets injured. The FBI agent gets injured. But, yeah, you do not want to steal an FBI agent's vehicle, and you don't want to injure him in the process. That's going to go bad for you, kid. But what got me scratching my head, too, Steve, is why does at 12:10 in the morning in the 300 block of South Morgan, nobody should be leaving their car running there. Most folks shouldn't even be there. There you are, and you go into the gas station. I don't know why you go in there anymore. Maybe you were going to get a soda. But for whatever reason, you left your vehicle running.
Well, Morgan's a little Tony now. It's the near west side, so.
Boy, oh boy.
Just go in for a minute, you know,
not
do a little
Tony
shopping.
Enough. You know, and the thing is, I see that a lot of times with municipal workers. They'll leave their...
That's not my car.
City. I know. That's totally what the attitude is. It's somebody else's gas. Nobody who is paying for the gas leaves their car running at a gas station. But you'll see tow truck drivers or sanitation, streets and sand guys or firefighters or police cars. And I understand that in the wintertime because, A, it's somebody else's gas, and, B, it's cold and you want to keep the car running and warm. I'm not sure the same theory applies in the summertime, where it's hot and you want to keep it cool in the car.
Well, sometimes you just don't want to flick your wrist to turn it off.
I think that's part of it. Yeah. There's something sort of comforting or luxurious or easier to having the car running. So I know people who leave the car running when they do fill up. Maybe this guy, instead of going to the store, was pumping gas. But the inconvenience of turning it on and off is enough to keep people running the car. And so you say, okay, if you're ever the victim of a crime, that's always on the criminal. But let's not make it easy for the criminals. And leaving your car door unlocked while the car is running is putting up a sign saying, well, if you're looking, here's an easy one. What's the guy doing leaving his car running? I don't understand that phenomenon. But he did.
Well, I also want to know what was making the lady so angry in the previous story.
Oh, why the lady was...
There are a lot of question marks in both those stories.
Well, she's drunk. Why? I guess she's an angry drunk. I don't understand it. I do not understand the belligerence when maybe she's embarrassed. I can't imagine they were making things worse. The medical crew that the firefighter sent to save her friend who's in the water that falls off her skidoo that she's driving drunk. Mm-hmm. So then they're tending to the person there. And she's making such a stink that they had to call the cops. The cops arrived, and now you should really be embarrassed and ashamed. And what does she do? She slaps the police officer? I've never been that drunk. And I'm not that kind of drunk. I think that's what it is. That's the kind of drunk some people are.
She picked the wrong group of people to take it out on.
Picked the wrong group of people to slap in the face because you had too much to drink.
Oh, yeah.
There's an obit in the paper today, and it made me think of something that I wanted to read to you. I want to find the line from the obit first, and I don't see it. Fair enough, I need to take a break anyway. But it has to do with a woman who was a scientist on the Manhattan Project from Chicago who just passed away. The number of people who were scientists on the Manhattan Project is dwindling by the day, sort of like World War II vets, right? And in this case, it's a woman who played a unique role. And there's a line in that that I have to read to you. I'll get to that next. Quintessential. They say this is the study people point to when they talk about election fraud, voter fraud in the United States. And the man who's behind that is a Loyola University. That's a Loyola of California University professor. He'll talk to us about the incidents of it and talk in a little more detail about this voter fraud commission the president has appointed. That's coming your way after 2 o'clock here on WGN. Thanks to Steve Bertrand, pardon me, Steve Cochran. Thanks to Steve Bertrand, too, for being Steve Bertrand. Thanks to Steve Cochran for inviting me on his show today. We got a chance to pitch to the morning show audience tickets for our Teddy Roosevelt show. That's the second Saturday in August at the College of DuPage. If you have not been to that show, do go to this show. You'll laugh, you'll learn, you'll live in the presence of a great president. It's amazing how quickly you forget that it really can't be the 26th president, but there he is up on the stage, and it's compelling, it's convincing, and I want you to come. Tickets are still available. Go to WGNradio.com/events for ticket information. John, I see people running into Dunkin' Donuts every morning. They leave their cars running, and they are city workers. Yeah, I don't understand that. I don't understand that. John, how about people leaving the cars running and the car door open while going to a mailbox or mailing a letter? Yeah, I guess so. And don't do that. This is the obit I was talking about. It's for Minnie Steinberg, who just passed away. She was born in 1920. From the Chicago Sun-Times today, Maureen O'Donnell wrote a little story about her. I won't read all of it here, but I'll get to a sentence in a second. It says, Minnie Steinberg has passed away. Her son talked a little bit about her to the reporter. To her last day, they said, she never divulged to her family all of the details of her work on the Manhattan Project. She was a biologist, a junior biologist, and she studied, among other things, the impact of radiation, say, from a nuclear explosion on human cells. So that was kind of her expertise. And when she worked at the in the project, they said, your work is secret. And if anybody said to her, what are you doing? She was instructed to never say, to her dying day. I mean, the war ended. She would still not divulge to her family the details of her work. In fact, they wrote to her last day, she didn't divulge to her family all the details of her work, quote, just general information she felt comfortable talking about. She's listed as a junior member of the health division, according to the Heritage Foundation of Atomic Research in Washington, D.C. She grew up in Stanislaw, Poland. She came to the United States with her family. She lived near 55th and Drexel. Minnie entered second grade at Kosminski Grade School without knowing English. The teacher would say a sentence in English, and a boy next to her would translate it into German, according to her grandson. She graduated from Hyde Park High School, and she earned an associate's degree from Wilson Junior College, and she started working at a lab at Mount Sinai Hospital, but she was bored just looking through the microscope, so she enrolled at the University of Chicago to continue her anatomy studies. During her vetting for the Manhattan Project, federal agents learned that she had once signed a Communist Party petition. They interviewed her neighbors and questioned her about party membership, but she thought it was like a social group, her son said. As a result of that experience, she told her children, always read what you sign. And that's the sentence that jumped out at me. I'll come back to that in a second. The Steinbergs had an abiding sense of gratitude to their homeland. There was no doubt in either of their minds, that is, the woman or her husband, that had they stayed in Europe and had not come to the United States in 1929 and 1933, they would have been dead from the war, from the Holocaust. Mrs. Steinberg drove until she was 91. She kept her hair colored auburn brown because she wanted to look good, her son said. And she never missed an episode of Downton Abbey. Survived by 13 grandchildren and 38 great-grandchildren. Services have been held. What a nice little tribute to Minnie Steinberg. Always read what you sign. I heard a microphone squeak.
That was me, but I'm going to let you tell your story.
I know. What were you going to say?
She just sounds so cool.
I know. What a nice lady.
And she took it to the grave.
I think that stories like this are I'm a sucker for the obits in the newspaper. And I like that sentence, always read what you sign, because that has been going through my head lately. You know how you get those DocuSigns? Steve or Elif, have either of you done something where they say, well, we'll just electronically transmit it to you,
yeah,
and
mm-hmm.
then you hit the DocuSign, it puts your initials in there, and that counts as your signature.
Mm-hmm.
It's so easy to just click through, click through, click through.
They've made it really easy.
I think they've made it a little too easy. Here's mm-hmm. a cautionary tale. So there I was in Minnesota getting ready for the big move to Chicago. I don't know if you know this, but I've recently moved to this city, and unfortunately now so have you.
You should talk more about this.
So here's what happens. Knowing that I was going to need to close out my cable account there in Minneapolis, I called them and said, hey, listen, in the next few months, I'm not going to need this account anymore. So what do I need to do to close it out? And they said, well, yakety smackety. And I said, thank you for that. And they said, by the way, for the next few months that you're going to have the account, you can qualify for a discounted rate. And I said, well, I'm not stupid. Sign me up. They said, okay, we'll send you the document. You just click away, and then you'll be signed up for the discounted rate. And I said, swell, thank you very much. When I got here, I discovered that I had inadvertently agreed to a 3-year term for a business account that I don't really have in Minneapolis. And when I explained to them, well, why would I try and close out an account and then commit myself to a 3-year term? Do you see, that's not what a rational, that's not what a person knowing what that little box they were clicking was doing would do. I shouldn't have to, you know, do that. And they said, no, you click the box, that's your signature, and it's sort of your responsibility to know what you're signing. That's how contracts work, dummy. And I said, well, can't we unclick it? You know, I did all the things you would do in a situation like that.
Did you ask why was I presented with this offer when I was trying to end my subscription?
I didn't, but I did say, well, you know how you say portions of this conversation may be recorded for quality control and training? I said, do you have the audio of that? Because I promise you guys did not mention that to me, even though it was in writing in front of me. But who reads those things? Hence Minnie's obituary, which is speaking to me from the other side now, which says,
yeah,
always read what you're signing. But, you know, you got pages of cable language there, and I just clicked.
Right.
And inadvertently now have committed myself to a more expensive than I had 36-month term that they won't let me out of.
And I'm sorry, 36-month term here or up there?
Well, they said you can transfer it, but either way, it's a 3-year agreement to a rate that's higher than what you were even trying to get out of. And I...
Did you say you better hope there aren't recordings of this conversation?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I know it's not funny.
Not funny to me, Steve.
It's a little funnier to us.
One of those things that I lie in bed at night thinking, I'm so angry about this.
Because you trust. You're a truster.
Well, I'm a mistake maker, but I said to them, well, here.
No one reads that stuff. No one reads that.
Was that the wrong mistake to make, according to Yogi Berra?
Yeah, right. Boy, I picked the wrong mistake to make with that company. Thanks, Elif. That helps out.
Well, no. Was that the only reason that they gave you is because you didn't read it? We're going to continue to punish you with this fee?
You sound like me now, because that's not their problem. You know, whatever reason I click that box, I click that box. That's a binding agreement now. So I have to abide by it. And, you know, the business accounts are more expensive than the residential accounts. And so that's kind of what I accidentally clicked onto is this business account. And they said, there's nothing we can do about it. And I said, well, there's certainly something you can do about it. You can tear this up. And they said, well, that's not how contracts work. We're not going to tear it up, said my cable company, just because you committed to something that you don't want. And I thought, I wonder how that works in real life for other people, too. Like if it was a face-to-face transaction at a store or something like that. You know, it's like if you bought a dress and you said, oh, I really don't want this dress, but I've worn it for a few months and I had been using cable for a few months. Could you take it back? They'd say no. But my explanation to them was, but you guys aren't out of anything, right? It's not like if we just tore this up now, you would somehow lose out, right? And they said, well, but we've been giving you a discounted rate for the last few months. That was what you signed up for, even if inadvertently. I said, I got a deal for you. Let's take that few months where I accidentally signed up for the 3-year deal but got the cheaper rate. I'll give you the difference from the old rate. I'll make good on the old rate. and they weren't interested in that either.
How high up did you go?
They said they have a loyalty program or some other division that handles these sorts of things. And that person was really good at keeping the money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's to the point now where I thought, well, what if I just stop paying? Because it's a really hard check or debit to automatically make, sending money on an account that you don't want or need. I thought, what if I just do that? And I thought, I don't know that that's my best move here, right? Like, I literally wonder, Steve, what would happen? Would my credit rating go bad because I'm delinquent on an account?
If you stop paying it?
Yeah.
Well, you're hoping that that won't even be the case. You're hoping that that won't even be in consideration.
What do you mean?
You're just hoping that they'll end that
right.
subscription.
Right, and they're not going to do that. So now I'm thinking, well, then screw it. I just won't pay. You know, then you get, that's what I said. Well, I'm not going to pay. I'm not going to pay this. I'm not paying this. And then I think what I do is I end up screwing my credit rating as a result.
Yeah, but you're old now. How much more credit are you going to need?
So that's kind of where I am.
So you're not going to use the same company here. You could, but you're not going
well,
to.
Well, I know. That's the thing. So now I'm like, well, we could transfer the account you don't want, but I'm so mad at them, I don't want to do that. But I probably am.
Well, I think you say, look, I can keep you,
right,
or I can cancel you.
Right, but well,
they can't charge you if you don't have a house.
The cancellation fee is 75% of the 3-year deal.
But
they said you can cancel, but it will charge you 75% to cancel. You have to send us 75% of what you owe. So because I could do that. I could say, screw it, then I won't use you guys in my new address. They say you now owe us 75% of the 3-year deal you didn't want. I said, well, then I'm not going to pay that. And then I thought, what happens if I don't? That's really the big mystery to me. If I just say, fine, screw it, I won't, do they come to my house? I don't know what happens then.
A quick response from a listener via text.
Yeah.
They said... I just lost it. You know how it scrolls up?
Yeah.
They said they're ripping you off, that they should give you the money.
Thank you.
They should just end the contract.
Thank you. I wish they were my old cable provider. It's 158. If you have words of wisdom on that, you can just text them.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Doing our best.
Here's John Williams.
See if I can't come up with one between now and... It's 209. Hi, it's John. We sure appreciate you tuning in. We're here until 3, then it's Roe.
Lord have mercy.
Anna will come strolling into the studio with their team of people, and that'll be really swell. We go back in this hour to a conversation that we had at the beginning of the show, and that was with Senator Dick Durbin, who issued a press release and then a conversation to us saying that he doesn't want to see Illinois or other states, for that matter, cooperate with this presidential commission to look into voter fraud. The president claimed that millions of people voted illegally in the 2016 presidential election, you may have heard. He tweeted, numerous states are refusing to give information to the very distinguished voter fraud panel. Capital letters, voter fraud panel. What are they trying to hide? An interesting story at CNN the other day, and it talked about at least one piece of research into voter fraud in the United States. A professor of law, Justin Levitt, tracked U.S. elections from the year 2000 to 2014, looking for voter fraud in more than a billion instances of votes cast. He found 31 instances of people pretending to be somebody they were not. 31 out of a billion. My guess is that there's more to it than that, but before we go any further, let's talk about this Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity with that very man, Justin Levitt. Professor, this is John Williams. You're on WGN Radio. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me on, John.
31 in a billion?
It's not that much. It turns out that fraud does happen, that there are isolated incidents of people sneaking into the polls and trying to pretend to be somebody else. But that's a really stupid way to steal an election, and so it's vanishingly rare. There are other kinds of fraud that do happen, mostly in sort of small-town elections. You've got vote-buying schemes. You've still got old-fashioned stuffing of the polls by poll workers on occasion. But they're really isolated. We're a pretty long way from the 60s, and people like to joke about the elections of the past, including Chicago elections, but things have gotten a lot more secure since then.
Hmm. So then talk just a little bit about this research you did from 20 to 2014. Were those federal elections, presidential elections, or were they state and local as well?
Any and all. So I was looking for anybody raising a hand, not prosecutions of crime, because it takes a pretty high standard for that, but anybody raising a hand saying, hey, I think somebody came to the polls and voted in my name, or came to the polls and voted in somebody else's name. And I discounted the ones that had been disproven. So I looked, and a lot of investigation, a lot of these claims evaporate. And it turns out that I'm left with a handful of incidents where people can credibly claim somebody voted in somebody else's name at the polls, municipal, state, federal elections, primaries, general elections, all kinds, more than a billion ballots with a B, and just 31 times people raised a hand. Now, I published that in 2014. I've gotten some other follow-ups since then. I'm up to 45. But that number is not going to change a whole lot. It's not going to get into the hundreds or thousands or hundreds of thousands. The sort of fraud that people are most worried about, I think it happens on very rare occasions, but it's not really widespread.
I wonder where the president then, because that's one kind of voter fraud, but there are other kinds of voter fraud, right? I mean, that's maybe too narrow a definition, too narrow a search, possibly?
Sure. So there are other kinds. They're also normally exaggerated when you hear about them in the news. That was aimed at the sorts of things. So ID rules are really controversial, and my study was aimed at the sort of things that ID rules could fix, pretending to be somebody else. There are other ways to try and monkey with the process. There are also all sorts of other mistakes that go on in the election process. The president in particular has alleged that there were between 3 and 5 million non-citizens who voted in the last election, and that is, frankly, nonsense. There is no credible support for that whatsoever. The number seems to come from a study that was based on an extremely small sample, and where errors in the sample itself might well have accounted for the entire number. The researchers who put out that study actually said, this is not how it should be used. We did not mean to support this. And so the fraud on the sort of scale that the president has alleged, there is absolutely no evidence that anyone has put forward to indicate that that's the case. And that brings to a problem with this commission that he's set up.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it seems like he's got an answer in mind and then has set up a process to conduct an investigation to arrive at the answer he's already got in mind. When you've already got a conclusion and then you set out to find the facts, that's not actually an investigation. That's either a witch hunt or a snipe hunt. It seems like he has set up a group of people to go out and seek evidence to justify what he's already got fixed in his mind to begin with. And the people he's chosen are people who have made similarly wildly inflated claims about voter fraud in the past.
Like
they've also, as you alluded, in your lead-up, they have put out a rather controversial request. Senator Durbin's not the only person to have urged resistance, showing that they're getting far out in front of themselves without actually doing their homework. And that is, unfortunately, something we've seen out of the folks leading the commission in the past.
Well, the commission is saying that they're only asking for information that's already publicly available. So they're not asking for any intrusion, anything extraordinary here. They're just saying, cooperate. That's the thrust of the president's tweet. States are refusing to give information to the panel. What are they trying to hide? Comment on that. Is this all public information? What specifically are they seeking?
Yeah, so they're seeking a lot of information, and they've asked for the stuff that's public. There are a couple problems with that, though. So in many states, it's public for some purposes, but not for all purposes. So for example, many states have restriction on commercial use of the voter file. The minute that the federal commission gets the data, it has to make it publicly available to anyone. And so any state that says you can't use this stuff to sell me something, the minute it delivers its data to the federal commission, that protection evaporates. Anybody can just go to the federal commission and say, I'd like all of the data from Illinois or from Texas or from one of the other states that has this prohibition, and get it and use it for whatever purpose they want. So that's one problem. Another problem is they have absolutely no indication of how they plan to secure this information. It's one thing to have a small amount of information from a small area. It's quite another to compile hundreds of millions of records. And some of the information they've asked for lends real questions to whether they've thought this through. So one of the things that the commission asked for is name and street address and an indication of military status, presumably to see whether people are voting overseas or not. But if you think about that, they have asked, they won't get, but they have asked for a list of the name and home address of every registered member of our military, and that's something that they would have to make instantly public. That's gobsmacking. And again, they're not going to get it because states aren't going to give them that information. But the fact that they've even asked for it lends some serious concern to whether they've done their homework in thinking this through first.
That bothers you because maybe somebody who has an agenda against the United States will strike out at those families or individuals?
There's a very good reason that the Department of Defense doesn't publish the name and home address of every member of the military. Yeah. And that's one particular problem. It is, frankly, a little more realistic to expect that the commission will get some information. It will be sloppy information, sloppily compiled, and then we'll use that information to try and justify wildly inflated claims of voter fraud. The fact that they're proceeding not very publicly and without doing their homework first, I think, has people concerned about the sort of conclusions they're going to come to.
Well, it's troublesome to us in here in Illinois that they sent the letter requesting the information to the wrong office, went to our Secretary of State, which normally handles that sort of thing, who then forwarded it, as it is handled in Illinois, to the voter commission or the election commission, but they actually didn't have the right address to send it to.
Yeah, and that's another good marker. You're not the only state to have recognized that. That's another good marker, the fact that the commission's not doing its homework very carefully. So the chair of the commission, by the way, a partisan statewide elected official who's running for partisan statewide office right now, Secretary Kobach from Kansas, is running to be Kansas governor. And to have somebody who's actually running for partisan office right now running this commission is not particularly promising. But he supervises elections in Kansas. He should know who runs elections in the other states. And as you've just said, when he sent his letter out, he sent it to everybody who had the same title as he does, but that's not who's in charge of the election process in a lot of different places.
Justin Levitt is a professor of law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles and is the author of, the researcher on this widely quoted study that for 14 years, over a billion votes cast and maybe only 45 instances of voter fraud surfaced. But that's, you said, where somebody impersonated somebody else and we were able to prove it. What about people voting multiple times? If I voted twice, that's not what you were looking for, right?
That's correct. And that does happen, again, occasionally. There are careful ways to deal with that, and there are consortiums of states, actually, that have joined up in order to look for that sort of misconduct. When it's done carefully, and when it's done with a lot of non-public identifiable information, so ways to figure out which people are which that aren't disclosed to the public, things like full Social Security numbers that never get out there, but that states can use if they have tight security measures. When that's done carefully and surgically, it's actually quite helpful. It helps to clean up the voter registration rolls. It helps to prevent misconduct. So the problem isn't with going out and seeking information about the state of the voter rolls. The problem is doing it in the way that this commission has so far demonstrated they're going to do it, and all in the service of trying to reach out and find facts for an absurd claim that didn't have any grounding to begin with.
What about this ID cards? I mean, at the end of the day, isn't this the sort of thing that would justify a national voter ID card or statewide voter ID cards, even if the president can't prove that a lot of people voted illegally, or if the conclusion of the commission is that not a lot of people voted illegally? Is this maybe going to arm that movement?
I think the fear is it's going to arm people with sloppy facts and not actually support election recommendations that people can have faith in. So every state right now, every single one, has some way for you to prove that you are who you say you are when you go into the polls. And for some people, first-time voters or voters who have registered by mail, there's a national law that has more exacting requirements for how you prove that you are who you say you are. The fight in this area really isn't over a lot of those ways. There are lots of ways to do it so that we have some security and that don't leave eligible voters out. And pretty much people think that's reasonable across the board.
Well, that's what this is about. I mean, nobody believes that 3 to 5 million people voted illegally in a handful of states for the president or for Hillary Clinton and that through the popular vote. That's just Trump fulminating, and so this commission's looking into it. But people, and that's not a concern of the average American, but this issue is. This issue is about voter ID card. I think that a lot of people think that it is, in fact, too easy to vote. That is, it's too easy to just show up and somebody could vouch for you. It doesn't seem to be very complicated or arduous to actually cast a ballot. There's no deep checking about the authenticity of you, the voter. I don't know what your reaction to that is, Professor, but I think that motivates people more.
Yeah, and I hear that concern. That's a legit concern. There are ways to improve the election process. I think so. There was a bipartisan bill passed after the 2000 election, and one of the slogans accompanying that federal bill, I think, is something that everybody can agree with. We want to make it easy to vote and hard to cheat, and that objective sounds like something that a lot of people can get behind. We want eligible people to be able to vote. We don't want ineligible people to be able to vote.
And you're here to tell me that, in fact, the former, that however easy to vote it is or is not, cheating is just not a rampant concern in the United States.
It's not a rampant concern because we've got some pretty good protections. Those protections could get better, for sure. If you're doing surgery, you can always improve the surgical tools and the surgical methods. But this commission is not set up in a way to do that. So if you want to look to a model, for example, 4 years ago, there was a commission that was set up in order to try and improve a lot of different facets of the election process, how to make sure eligible people could vote better and more conveniently and more fairly, how to make sure ineligible people couldn't, and how to make those security measures tighter. It was a commission that was set up with a top Democratic campaign lawyer and a top Republican campaign lawyer, with election officials with deep experience in the election process, with folks from industry, because it turns out that when you're talking about customer service and logistics, there are some business leaders who know a thing or two about that. And it came out with a bunch of really balanced, really moderate, really common sense, sort of straight up the middle recommendations.
Okay, I want to hear what a couple of those are. And I want to just get a caller text in real quick. Justin Levitt's on the phone line, professor of law at Loyola. Now, you may be one of those callers or texters right now. 312-981-7200. We're talking about this special commission that the president appointed to look into the integrity of the election process. And when you see stories about this, you often see them referencing a story or a study done by Justin Levitt, a professor of law at Loyola's law school in Los Angeles, having studied over a billion votes cast over 14 years, state, local, and federal. He found 30, maybe 45 instances of voter fraud, somebody impersonating somebody else, the sort of thing that maybe a voter ID card would fix. He said that's a solution looking for a problem. Justin, just before I just take a couple quick calls and texts, and then I'll let you go. What about this notion that, okay, maybe it's not a big deal, but what's the harm in looking? Let's just go ahead and sniff around and see what we see. Everybody send in the stuff, and that's what research is like sometimes, and maybe it'll surprise us, maybe it won't. What's the worst that could happen with a commission like this?
The worst that could happen is sloppy research leading to sloppy recommendations. So you're right. I'm a professor. I love research. I do research all the time. And there is a way to do this research carefully. States themselves have joined forces, and I'm talking red states and blue states working together, to do this carefully and slowly in a lot of ways that have protections for private information. The sorts of information that the commission is asking for and compiling aren't a particularly good indication that they're doing this thoughtfully or well. And so when you just throw a lot of garbage into the mix, you're going to get a lot of garbage out. I have no problem with doing more, forensic analysis, doing more surgery on the voter rolls or on particular election processes. But you got to do it right, or else you can't have confidence in what comes out the other end.
I wonder what they would do with all of this. They get the Social Security numbers, the addresses, the mother's maiden name, that sort of thing. Then what? How do they determine if there's been voter fraud?
So one thing that the secretary has said he wants to try to do is to match up this national list of hundreds of millions of people to other federal records, like a list of people working their way through the immigration process or a list of people who have died. There are problems, by the way, there are errors in each of those other lists. But the biggest constraint is that it's very difficult to do that reliably using public information. You can do it more reliably with private information. Something like a full Social Security number is a fairly good way to know that John Smith in one place is John Smith in another. But if you only are working off public information, things like the name and year of birth, it's really hard to know that John Smith born in 1954 is the same John Smith as you got somewhere else, John Smith born in 1954. And the concern is that the commission's not setting itself up to do this right. It's setting itself up to make mistakes.
I got that. I wonder, though, if it's a little more pernicious, too. People worry that the government sort of collecting this sort of massive amount of data from all of the citizens can be used in a way that isn't what they first advertised.
Yeah, well, that's certainly right. Some of the information that he's asked for and won't get could certainly be misused. Again, I think you mentioned that he has asked for military affiliation and home street address. That's not a particularly good idea to make public. Other concerns that people have are just giving the information over to a federal entity that doesn't have very well laid out security plans, or information about their voter history or their party affiliation. There are federal laws, actually, that are pretty severe about requiring a group like this to do their homework before they ask for information on citizens, particularly when it's personal information or information relating to the voting process. And even running through those hoops, even sort of presenting their homework as the federal law requires, would ease a lot of concerns. There's no indication the commission has done that yet here. Again, it seems to be barreling ahead. And I guess part of the worry is, if they're barreling ahead, what are they barreling ahead toward?
Okay, it's 2:32. I'm out of time. I got a couple of calls. Some of them are on board. Some of them are not and are angry at you. I think what we should do is see what the results are later this summer. Is this thing hasn't even had its first meeting. They're going to meet. They're going to have some speeches, and then we'll see what happens. But you've been very helpful today, Professor, and we're certainly going to call you back again down the road.
I look forward to it, and thanks very much to you and your listeners.
If anybody should be paying attention to this, it is Chicago, which is the butt of the vote twice jokes. It's 2:32. That's Justin Levitt, professor of law at the Loyola School of Law in Los Angeles. Nice summer day, huh, in Chicago? Some sun and some clouds. What'd you say the current temperature is there, Mr. Bertrand?
It is 91 degrees.
Wow, 91 degrees.
Hot as a firecracker.
Yeah, no kidding. I'll tell you, every time I see a story about somebody lost their hand, because they were.
How many stories do you see like that?
Well, there was another one this
year.
There
are a few. I know.
Is your point that it's not that's apocryphal? It doesn't happen as often as we.
Well, it happens,
pretend it
but
happens?
It doesn't. I don't think it happens very often.
Yeah. Did you used to light firecrackers in your hands and then throw them in the air?
Sure.
All the time as a kid, we did. And then we all sit there and go, "Oh, these people are idiots." Well, you were once too. Listen to this story. It's from the Chicago Tribune. Christian crisis pregnancy centers in the south and far western suburbs are challenging a change in the state's right of conscience law that since January requires physicians and nurses to notify pregnant patients of all of the available options, including abortion. So if you go to a crisis pregnancy center, they have to, by law, tell you about birth control. They have to, by law, tell you about abortion. If they say, yeah, but that's against my personal beliefs, then what do we do about that?
It's like a flip of the laws, the pro-life or anti-choice laws that would require clinics to show, you know, sonograms
of the baby.
Of babies to try to maybe convince women not to have an abortion. This is the flip side, saying, well, you could always have an abortion.
And that's the law in Illinois. And if you are a Christian center, of course, that's quite counter to your core beliefs. You don't like the state saying that you have to offer that, at least that information is an option to the patient. That's, you know, asking a good Christian to commit ethical malpractice. That's the theory behind that. You know, it's funny because when I first saw this story, I was thinking that it was what you were describing, Steve. That's
right.
The version of this
No.
I'm more familiar with. But
right.
No, this is the quite opposite of that. The lawsuit filed against the state officials, includes the governor himself, claiming that their constitutional free speech rights are violated by the changes to the law because they have to give information they find morally wrong.
Yeah, and you used the term good Christian. I know you didn't mean it. I mean, because there certainly are Christians who don't have the same issue with abortions that others do, right? So you can, good Christian implies that their version is the correct one, but.
Sure, right. Some Christians are pro-choice, in other words.
Right, right.
Well, not our guest on the phone right now. This is, I want to make sure I got the right phone lineup. Thomas Hulp, who is a board member for the Thomas More Society. Tom, this is John Williams. You're on WGN Radio. How are you this afternoon?
Fine, thank you very much.
That's my understanding of the story so far. Did we get that right, or what would you insert into what you've heard so far?
Well, no, I think you've got it pretty accurately stated. These are Christian pregnancy centers, and their whole mission is to engage with pregnant women. And these are pregnant women who have crisis pregnancies, unplanned pregnancies, and who are contemplating abortion. And their mission is to talk to these women and say, hey, you know, there's other alternatives to abortion. So for them to have the state step in and say, oh, well, you will talk to them about abortion, and you will tell them about the benefits of abortion, and you will give them information about an abortion clinic to go to, that's, you know, strikes at the heart of their conscientious objection to abortion.
Or even their purpose for being, because I'm not real familiar with what we're talking about here, these centers you're describing, but are you saying that the very purpose of these centers is to talk to women about alternatives to abortion?
That's correct.
So it's a
religious mission. They're funded by donations. There's about 100 of them in Illinois.
Do the women that go there know that? I mean, do they know what they're getting when they walk into the door? This is somebody whose purpose is going to be to encourage me to keep the baby?
Well, you know, the approach of the pregnancy centers is to offer information that they may not have. So, you know, it's true that they're, and essentially the problem with a problem pregnancy is that the woman's getting a lot of input to say, go have an abortion. It's a quick and easy solution to your problem. And so the pregnancy centers are there to say, hey, wait a minute, there's long-term consequences to this. You know, you're killing your child, your unborn child, et cetera, et cetera. And so their job is to provide fuller information. And admittedly, it's based upon Christian principles.
Sure, because if you say kill your unborn child, then that's, I'm not sure if that's informing as much as it is persuading, or persuading you to your view of the situation, right?
That's right. And most of pregnancy centers are non-judgmental.
Well, that sounds very judgmental, by the way.
It does sound judgmental, but in order to, you know, in order to convince somebody to do something, you have to be non-judgmental. You know, you have to accept the fact that they can have an abortion. They're well aware of it, right? They're trying to find out, hey, what should I do here? And so a pregnancy center is there to try to give them information based upon a sincere belief as to what's good for the woman.
You think that you can know that without offering them that other half of the equation, though? I mean, if your interest was purely what's best for the woman, maybe her decision to keep the baby and raise it or give it up for adoption is best for the woman. But maybe what's best for that woman at that time in her life under these circumstances is to terminate the pregnancy, as is allowed by law. If your interest is just her, then how can you limit her options?
In no way do the pregnancy centers limit her options. Everyone is well aware that she can have an abortion, and the woman that comes is interested in hearing information about alternatives, so that she can make a good decision.
Yeah, that's interesting.
There's no way that the pregnancy center can make a decision for that woman.
Yeah.
The woman has to make a free decision herself.
I guess it just depends on the circumstances and the individual. You make it sound as though these people are walking into the door asking to be persuaded to keep the child. Like, you give me that version, that one side of the story. Is that your sort of assessment of what happens there?
Well, the women who reach out to these pregnancy centers are conflicted. It's an inherently moral decision to have an abortion, and they're very conflicted about it.
So they walk, because I'm under the impression that generally what happens is somebody's pregnant, they don't know what to do. They go into this crisis pregnancy center, and maybe the best thing to do is give them the range of options. Even if you paint abortion as, one that may be the worst of your options, at least present that to them as an option. That's what the state requires. I don't know how onerous that requirement is. I don't know that they have to go into any great detail, but they need to just present that to them as an option.
Well, the point, though, is that they're well aware that it's an option, and pregnancy centers will readily discuss it. The point that what the pregnancy centers don't want, though, is the state to start mandating what they should say about it. And right now, very positively, the state is telling them, you will tell them about the abortion center down the street.
Mm-hmm.
And that's compelled government speech. That's against the First Amendment, and it's against their rights of conscience.
Yeah.
So,
right, because
does the state have a compelling interest to do that? Our argument is no, because it's very clear that anybody with a cell phone or an internet connection can find out where any abortion clinic is, et cetera.
Thomas, where does this go next? What do you think your chances are, and how does this case have? I presume there's been something like this in the past. Is there a precedent?
There's an effort throughout the country in various different ways to essentially mainstream abortion. About over 85% of OBGYNs will not get involved with abortion, and the people who want to promote abortion want this to. They want to make it disappear as a moral issue. And so they're trying to get their foot in the door to force speech in these little areas so that they can then do more later. There was a recent opinion piece in the New England Journal of Medicine that said, hey, we should get rid of all conscientious objection for OBGYNs. There shouldn't be any. They should just do what we in the majority decide should be done.
The centers
that's the larger battle that's being fought here throughout the country.
The centers that you're representing, do they receive state or federal funding?
No.
It's entirely privately funded?
Correct.
So it's not like the government has its strings attached to them this way?
No. And what's so pernicious about this is that they wrote it right into the Healthcare Right of Conscience Act. That act was passed in 1977, right after Roe v. Wade, to protect the conscience rights of practitioners, basically to say, hey, you will not have to get involved in abortion. And so now they've written this exception in to say, oh, but you will tell them where the abortion centers are, and you will discuss the benefits of abortion. So, they're trying to erode the Healthcare Right of Conscience law here in Illinois to the detriment of pro-life physicians. And it's not good for them, and it's not good for anybody that's concerned about conscience. Conscience is very important for every human being because everybody has to make moral decisions.
I understand that, but it seems to me like you're most interested in clearing your conscience, not theirs. That's their private, personal decision. And for whatever reason, they may regret going forward with the pregnancy as well. It's their conscience. It's not yours.
That's not true, John. It's actually the interaction between the physician and the patient. So it's a dialogue that goes on. That's what's being protected here. It's the full ability of a physician to act as a full human being in terms of moral values, professional skill and expertise, et cetera.
Thomas, just a quick question about that. The people at these how do we describe them? These Christian pregnancy crisis centers?
Yeah, crisis pregnancy centers.
There's people that work there. Are they counselors? Are they physicians? Are they nurses? What's their background, generally speaking?
In the medical centers, the pregnancy center will offer a pregnancy test and then an ultrasound. Those are medical procedures. They're done under the direction of a medical director, a physician.
A physician.
There might be Yeah, so there's a technician that runs an ultrasound machine, and there may be a nurse involved too. But primarily, they're lay counselors and lay assistants. Basically, they're other women.
John, no one here's a bunch of texts. No one has ever looked at abortion as a quick way to fix anything. This texter says abortions should be included since we're, John, women know there are alternatives to abortion. What will the agencies do after the baby is born? So you persuade the woman to have the child. Do you encourage her to put that child up for adoption, or what happens then?
Well, there's basically three alternatives to a pregnancy. One is you keep the baby and parent the baby. Two is you put the baby up for adoption. Or three is you abort the baby. So these three options are ones that a woman is thinking about. And so the pregnancy center is going to be dealing with them. And a lot of them do have, you know, obviously referral kinds of information and all kinds of assistance to help women deal with the admittedly, you know, difficult experience of having an unplanned pregnancy. But they're well aware of the woman's overall health. You know, it's a common rap to say, oh, you just care about the baby and you don't care about the mom. But you have to care about the mom and the baby. But to be pro-life, you have to care about both. And people who are pro-choice, they always ignore the baby.
A couple of quick questions here. Mary had a comment or a question. You're on WGN. Go ahead, Mary.
Hi. Yeah, I just, you know, this is always a difficult conversation because on the side of people who are pro-choice, which means that you believe that a woman should either keep or terminate a pregnancy based on their own desires, it's very difficult to listen to the kind of sort of moral grandstanding that we're hearing on the phone. One of the things that I think is being left out of this gentleman's conversation is the fact that access to healthcare is getting more and more difficult every day, especially for your working poor population. That means access to birth control, but that also means access to pregnancy, prenatal care, but also to abortion services. And so when a pregnancy crisis center pops up in a neighborhood where perhaps there isn't a free clinic, a place to get prenatal care, a place to hear an alternative option, and someone finds themselves in an unplanned pregnancy and they wander into a pregnancy crisis center, very often they don't even know that that's a fundamentally Christian-based anti-abortion type clinic. They're just there to seek health care. Now, when the gentleman said that it's run with the oversight of a medical director, all that necessarily means is that there's a doctor whose name is on the letterhead. That doesn't necessarily mean that there's actually a physician talking.
All right. Hold on a second, Mary. Hold on a second. You got a lot of ideas and information there, and I'm running short of time. Let's let him respond to that, Mary. I appreciate your call. I truly do. Thomas, your thoughts about all of that?
I would just point out that, you know, there's an attitude that the woman has to make a decision between herself and her physician or her significant other. But what we're finding is that people like Mary are wanting the state to step in that relationship and force that conversation. And we are against that. We think it should be between the woman and her doctor, but without state interference.
I'm out of time, Thomas. This case, I presume, is going to go forward. We'll follow it here and invite you back on the show another day.
Yes, thank you very much. I appreciate your asking.
Thomas Ulp is a board member for the Thomas More Society. They're filing a suit against the state of Illinois, including the governor, saying that those counseling providers should not have to include information about abortion services in the state of Illinois. Anna DeVlantis is in the studio getting ready for the afternoon show.
Hi, John. How are you doing today?
Is this the first time you and I have spoken since the 4th of July?
I think it is, since prior to the holiday. Do you have a good holiday?
There's two kinds of people, those who shoot fireworks and those who do not. Which kind are the DeVlantises?
Well, we kind of shot some of those fireworks. We did. But, you know, just little sparklers and things like that. Nothing wrong with that.
Were you the ones doing it outside the window, making my dog use the bathroom on the inside of the house?
I feel so bad for the dogs, don't you? Because the dogs are just not happy with the whole
celebration.
Well,
do you have a dog?
No. I want to get a dog, but not yet. We're not ready yet.
That's what we're going to do. I think if you want to fire firecrackers, fine, from your house, from your neighborhood, from your roof, but you have to buy a dog the day before. And if you want to do it,
deal with it.
That would solve the problem. You know, the cops can't tell which is gunfire and which are fireworks. It's a problem as
well,
it
is.
A problem. But if we made everybody who uses firecrackers buy a dog, I think this problem would go away.
I like that idea. Make that proposal. Send it to Springfield because they've got some problems passing things.
Yeah,
right
they're
now.
Not busy. They've got time for this.
We'll be covering that, of course. The white powdery substance found in Springfield, the hazmat crews that delayed the budget vote. So we'll bring you the very latest on what's happening down there today. We've got Eric Rung from WGN-TV. He's going to check in with us. Mark Sapelsa as well. We've got Skilling. Top 5 at 5 today, of course, is going to be phenomenal. And Congressman Kinzinger to update us on all the things going on in Washington.
I'll get out of the way.